In a building of gold with riches untold lived the families in which the country was founded. And the merchants of Star with their vain velvet smiles were there, for they also were hounded. And the soft middle class crowded into the last, for the building was fully surrounded. And the noise outside was the ringing of revolution. Sadly they stared and sank in their chairs and searched for comforting notion. And the rich silver walls looked ready to fall as they shook in doubtful devotion. The ice cubes would clink as they freshened their drinks, wet their minds in bitter emotion. And they talked about the ringing of revolution.
And with the ringing of the inimitable voice of Phil Oakes from Phil Oakes in Concert release, we start today's Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland, be with you for the next hour. We've got on the phone my guest for the hour, Bruce Levine, and the reason for having Phil Oakes will be soon apparent as we talk about his new, relatively new book, came out last fall, Resisting Illegitimate Authority, A Thinking Person's Guide to Being an Anti-Authoritarian, Strategies, Tools, and Models. Let me just welcome you before I got to make a couple announcements, Bruce. Good morning.
Good morning there, Paul.
Were you glad to hear your old favorite Phil Oakes?
Yes, yes, makes me happy when somebody starts an interview with a Phil Oakes song. That's a different one. Usually folks will do other ones, so it's nice to hear that one.
All right. Well, you know, we need a little of that spirit. Okay, so as I said, I need to make a couple announcements. If you heard last week's show, I read a statement by that came from that was approved by the board of directors here at KABU, supporting the Compassionate Change District in the Central East Side here, where our studios sit, from Powell to 84 and the river to 12th, somewhere around there. Anyway, there's a proposal to create this Enhanced Services District, which a lot of people, including myself, feel is just a code name for rapidly intensifying gentrification and the exclusion and further exclusion and marginalization of houseless people and other poor folks. And so there's a hearing on that. That's this morning at 10:05 a.m., where there will be a discussion on this. I'm not sure exactly what they're going to discuss, but apparently there's been some discussions between this coalition that's supporting the Compassionate Change District and the Central East Side Industrial Council, which has been pushing this Enhanced Services District. And so there may be possibly merging the visions to, as this update from last week says, to build a Central East Side that solves the problems we all share arising from inequitable access to housing and city services. This coalition partners bring to the table knowledge, expertise, and experience needed for Portland's Central East Side to be an innovator and take the path less traveled towards real solutions and community willingness that can be achieved only when all perspectives are valued, understood, and heard. Again, that will be at the Portland City Council downtown at 10:05 a.m. this morning, if you get a chance to go. And of course, one of the lead voices in that coalition is the group Right to Survive, and three members of that group will be actually presenting tonight for the Rethinking Psychiatry monthly public event, as they have every first Wednesday from 7 to 9 p.m. now at the Montevilla United Methodist Church, which is 232 Southeast 80th Avenue. And this is on houselessness, trauma, and solutions. A lot of different issues will be presented, and Ibrahim Mubarak, Lisa Fay, and Sarah Louise will be presenting should be an important event that if you can get out there, will be well worth your time. Okay, Bruce Levine, as I said, has a new book out. I just realized, Bruce, that it's been almost exactly 6 years since I had you on the one and only time, and I kept on meaning to have you back on, and it's taken a while. But then we were talking about your previous book, Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. You've also written Surviving America's Depression Epidemic, How to Find Morale, Energy, and Community in a World Gone Crazy, and Common Sense Rebellion, Taking Back Your Life from Drugs, Shrinks, Corporations, and a World Gone Crazy. You can see a very common theme in merging your own perspective as a practicing clinical psychologist and, apparently, reading your book, a lifetime anti-authoritarian with a very acute political perspective, analysis and perspective, and a very strong sense of empathy, if I might say. You've been contributing to Salon, Counterpunch, Alternate, Truth Out, Z Magazine, Huffington Post, and your articles and interviews have been published in the New York Times, Skeptic, Adbusters, elsewhere. You're on the editorial advisory board of the journal Ethical Human Psychology and Psychiatry, and on the medical and scientific advisory board of the National Center for Youth Law, another strong theme. Again, if people have been reading your stuff, you've been helping and attempting to help troubled youth for your, your entire career as a clinical psychologist. You're also a member of Psychologists for Social Responsibility, the International Society for Ethical Psychology and Psychiatry, and Mind Freedom. I mention all these because I think it's important for people to know about these groups. And you live in Cincinnati, Ohio. So once again, good morning, Bruce Levine.
Good morning again.
So maybe just start out, we'll talk about Phil Oakes, but talk about, I guess, what authoritarian and anti-authoritarian mean, and then maybe you can start using Phil Oakes as an example.
Sure. I mean, the definition of authoritarian is just pretty simple. It's just unquestioning obedience to an authority. So for an authoritarian in power, they demand unquestioning obedience, and then authoritarian subordinates, they will provide that unquestioning obedience, okay? And so an anti-authoritarian, in contrast, is not necessarily opposed to all authority. We'll get to that later, but certainly an anti-authoritarian is not going to provide unquestioning obedience. So what they're going to do is they're going to assess an authority to see whether that authority is legitimate or not legitimate, so based on several criteria, whether that authority is honest, they know what they're talking about, they actually care about people who are trusting them, they're exploitative, you know, and if that anti-authoritarian assesses an authority to be illegitimate, not legitimate, they're going to challenge that authority and they're going to resist that authority. And so that's what resisting illegitimate authority is about. It's about a book about anti-authoritarians, and it's a book really for anti-authoritarians.
Yeah, and of course I already mentioned that you talk about Phil Oakes in the book as excuse me, as one example of, you have a number of categories to within which to discuss, you know, historical figures, anti-authoritarian figures, those who have made great contributions yet were still marginalized, those who are criminalized. You talk about Native Americans as anti-authoritarian. You talk about one of the themes that I think we should talk most about, if we can, because this is about the psychiatric assault, the assault against people who are vulnerable because of having extreme experiences or being under great distress or vulnerable, psychically vulnerable, and they are unfortunately preyed upon, unfortunately, by the culture we live in. The assault on young authoritarians, as I said, you've treated or worked with a lot of young people. Then you have those who have hurt themselves or their cause, and I think Phil Oakes is there because he committed suicide. Anyway, it goes on. So let's start out by talking about Phil Oakes. I know you talk also about your own history, your kind of coming to consciousness as an anti-authoritarian. And for people like yourself, obviously well, we all need examples of people. Sometimes it's hard to actually find our way to, you know, to get validated in our resistance to illegitimate authority, and figures like Phil Oakes might provide a voice.
Yes, I mean, what I wanted to do after I initially kind of laid out the landscape of authoritarians, anti-authoritarians, went through some theory, I wanted to talk about how they're assaulted. But then ultimately, the biggest section of the book, part three, is about tragedy and triumph. And it was real important for me to not romanticize anti-authoritarians, because some of the anti-authoritarians, as I make clear, I have sympathy for everybody I talk about. There's 20 anti-authoritarians who I profile at great length. I talk about it several others, but at great length I profile 20. And all of these folks were folks that really meant something to me, because they taught me something about the nature of United States and anti-authoritarianism, and also taught me something about how that anti-authoritarian person could move into a tragic life versus a triumphant life. And ultimately, at the end of the day, for me, what I wanted to do was to provide, this book is written, you know, it's a book for anti-authoritarian readers who are trying, at some level, knowing, wow, it may be difficult for me to survive at all in the United States. And they're correct. And we can talk about that in more detail later, all the assaults that are on them. But that some folks move into some survival just happens to do with good luck. So I don't want to minimize luck being a factor. But there's also a lot of wisdom that some folks use, and I go through at the end of the book about eight very triumphant anti-authoritarians. But I also talk about folks who moved into some tragedy, and in that, back to Phil Oakes, he is in a section for me of folks, again, who I have a lot of affection for. He's a childhood hero of mine, Phil Oakes, but he moved into a pretty tragic life. I mean, ultimately, as you said, he killed himself in his thirties, in mid 1970s. And so I thought there was a lot to be learned about from Phil Oakes, about what his anti-authoritarianism was all about, and why, you know, some of the reasons that he moved into the self-destructive behaviors ultimately leading to him killing himself.
One reason, you know, Phil Oakes resonates with me among many other figures of that era, of course, is because it was, you know, one of the last moments of large-scale anti-authoritarianism, where it was much easier to validate, as I said, challenging in a lot of times very overt ways, and sometimes kind of large scale ways, which is can make it a lot easier for sure. When you're say you're the only kid in school who, you know, whatever, whether you're gay, you're trans, whether you're, you know, anti-authoritarian by, you know, is it by nature, is it by family, is it by culture, who knows, maybe you have some theories about that, what makes an anti-authoritarian. But if you're someone who does not cut in the mold of whatever the, you know, the dominant cliques or the dominant culture of a school, it's going to be really, really hard, or school or family or whatever your environment, small town. So, you know, the 60s was a time when people, you know, now people find the internet, which I think is not quite so healthy as finding a flesh and blood group of people to resist together or create an alternative together. Anyway, so Phil Oakes, but of course, you know, he committed suicide after that, and I think that was a big factor, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think, you know, there have been more anti-authoritarian eras in American history. Certainly the 1770s, I talk about Thomas Paine, you know, and he became a star, he became a hero, and then, you know, he stayed an anti-authoritarian, continuing to challenge illegitimate authorities past the British rule, including George Washington, including organized religion, and America moved into a far less anti-authoritarian culture by the early 1800s, and so he becomes shunned, he becomes ostracized. The last several years of her life are quite miserable. And, you know, we have similar times where in the 1890s and early 1900s, prior to World War I, you have anarchist, socialists, huge anti-authoritarian populations in the United States. And so a lot of folks are having pretty good anti-authoritarian lives, and then following Wilson and following, you know, people being thrown in, you know, prison here for speaking out against World War One. You have people moving into having more alienated, miserable lives, getting deported, getting in prison. And so you see similar thing that happened for folks in the 1960s. It was a pretty anti-authoritarian era in America. So you have Phil Oakes coming along at just the right time where, you know, first of all, the genre of not only folk music, but his particular genre of political protest folk music is become significant enough so that he can make a good living. And he becomes somewhat of a star. I mean, he's the guy who's the guy who they call him Tom Paine with a guitar in that era. And he's the guy who's showing up at all the anti-war protests. He's the guy at the Chicago Democratic Convention. He's the guy who's like singing, you know, I ain't marching anymore, and people are burning their draft cards. He is like become, you know, he's really feeling excited. He's got a lot of people who are going to his concerts. And then what happens in that era, for, you know, Nixon gets reelected, you have Kent State, and by the mid-1970s or even earlier, you know, you have people just feeling like, wow, you know, the authorities in this society here, they don't care at all about what we have to say. They don't care about, you know, we can protest the heck out of Vietnam, we can protest, we're still, you know, going in there and killing people, assassinating folks there in Chile. This really hurt, this was really upsetting for Phil Oakes, who had become, you know, very connected with a political folk singer, Victor Jara, in Chile, and it was really upsetting for him when he got with CIA involvement and the whole Allende coup, and Jara gets assassinated. So he, along with a lot of other folks, move into a lot of pain about, like, you know, we thought we could really change the world here. We thought we could change things, and they really, in many ways, underestimated how powerful these authoritarian forces were in the United States and how they could really ignore, imprison, not care, and that ultimately people start drifting apart. So I talk about some folks who move into violence in that era and ultimately in some ways make it easier for authoritarians. We talk a little bit about the Weathermen, what happened to them, initially anti-authoritarian folks who were part of the SDS and again thought they could stop the war in Vietnam, that they could, you know, change a racist society, and then they realized, wow, we're not doing anything here, and they took their pain and ultimately moved into violence, in a lot of ways made the United States even a more authoritarian society. We could talk about how that works. But you have guys like Phil Oakes, who took their pain and instead of, you know, they ended up attacking themselves. They became very depressed. He moved into a lot more substance abuse, a lot more problematic behaviors, and then he had some bad luck, and ultimately he's just despondent by the mid-1970s, and he hangs himself.
And of course, you talk about figures who you know, or didn't turn on themselves and were able, for a lot of reasons that you lay out in your book, whether it's actually a really strong sort of political analysis, whether it's anarchist, whether it's a spiritual grounding like Buddhism, you talk about that. You mentioned the God of Spinoza and Einstein, and then the Enneagram, which I don't know if we'll get a chance to talk about that. And then you have a, you know, lessons from anti-authoritarians who have helped themselves in their cause. You mentioned Thoreau, Scott Nearing, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, Helen Keller. Well, those are two strike hitters, as you say. Anyway, it's a very nuanced presentation. Maybe before we go to our first callers, because there are some people waiting at 503-231-8187, you know, just lay out you know, it's such a complex issue, but what are some of the main reasons that you feel like people are able to maintain their integrity, you know, fight the good fight, and maintain their own personal equilibrium?
Well, one of the examples I give, like, who a lot of folks in your audience would know, so I talk about a few folks who are still alive, but Noam Chomsky is an anti-authoritarian anarchist, and he would be the first to admit that a lot of why he ended up having a more successful, triumphant, pretty happy life with family and not really out of control financially was luck. I mean, he had some lucky breaks in his life, that there were a few times where he just would have quit college and, you know, that, and but some lucky things happened, and then during the Vietnam protest era there, where he was also refusing to pay some a percentage of his taxes. He was getting arrested. And again, it was just, as he's the first to say, just by luck that he didn't have his life ruined by being in prison, as was the case by many other anti-war activists in American history, including Eugene Debs, but many others. So he would be the first to say that some of it was luck. But in addition to luck, I think there's some other pieces of wisdom that a guy like Noam Chomsky and several others who I talk about did. One was there's smarts about money. And so I know it's hard for a lot of people, especially who are anarchists, to accept the reality that money matters in America here. I mean, it does. And so even you have, I talk about people like the anarchist Emma Goldman, who was about as hardcore an anarchist as you could possibly be, anti-capitalist person. But she realized that in order to survive, you have to care about ways to make a buck. And so she would learn her public speaking was a way to make money. She did nursing. She did a whole other bunch of things so that she was never completely out of control financially. And she was able to help all her anarchist buddies who much more eschewed money making. And so, you know, money making does matter. I mean, and even if some, I know this is a very hard thing for, like I say, a lot, certain anti-authoritarians who are anarchists to accept that reality. But hey, if you're living in America, you know, you're going to be a burden on yourself, a burden on others, if you don't at least deal with that reality one way or another. And the folks who are more triumphant, they do. The second thing, you know, that they all do is, the ones who are more triumphant, is they really care about relationships. They care about not being around people who are hurtful, who are exploitive, who don't care about them. And as we can get, you know, that was one of the mistakes with Phil Oakes too. I mean, a lot of people he associated with were not really positive forces for him. People who maybe he thought were his friends, but people who really cared about him view them as sort of dragging him down. Maybe even leading to greater sort of narcissism on his part. And so once people who are anti-authoritarians get sort of overwhelmed by their own pain, and they either hang out in more problematic relationships or they get too self-absorbed, they can really deteriorate. And so another thing that is really important for people who are anti-authoritarians is what they do with their anger. So if you're going to be an anti-authoritarian in the United States or most places, you're going to have a lot of anger. You're going to have anger for what's being done to you. You're going to be having anger what's being done to your friends, to your society. There's a lot of sources of anger, and so how you deal with that anger is usually pretty important. So those are some of the areas that I noticed that made a difference. Like I say, in addition to some having some good luck, were those people who were more anti-authoritarians I describe in the book, from Jane Jacobs to Frederick Douglass to Helen Keller to several others, who ended up having pretty decent lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm speaking with Bruce Levine, author of the book that's been out for just a few months on PM Press, Resisting Illegitimate Authority, A Thinking Person's Guide to Being an Anti-Authoritarian, Strategies, Tools, and Models. And, well, as I said, this is a talk show, as everybody knows who listens, 503-231-8187, and we have a couple people waiting. So let's go to Jeremy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to describe the poster I have in a prominent position in my dining room. It says in large black letters, the F word and authority. And in the lower left-hand corner, there's a tiny cartoon of a mouse saying, all authority, and some humanoid saying, yep, all authority. And I'd like you to perhaps talk about what kind of authority you consider legitimate, because I think, you know, there's very little of that. There's a famous article by Engels called On Authority, and he talks about and Engels was much more authoritarian than Marx, I believe, but I'm not a huge fan of Marx, so I think it was pretty authoritarian. But he talks about the captain of the ship, and I've done a little sailing, and that's a legitimate authority, but it can be easily abused by the captain. You know, you need to listen to the people you're ordering around. Obviously, there are life-threatening situations where if they accept the idea that you know more than they do, you should do what they say. But I basically stopped sailing because I kept running into authoritarian captains. Anyway, So I'd like to hear you talk about
this. This is a hugely, thanks, Jeremy. Thanks for bringing this issue up, because this is a hugely important issue here about, like, what is, you know, there's some people who just, like, you know, like you quote that famous sign, like, F, you know, authority, like, it's like, and not, and as I go into the book, you know, I quote famous, actually, anarchists who talk about that. That's not the way, that's not what they believe, that they're not all anti-authority. So one of the examples, I give an example from the famous anarchist Bakunin, who's not opposed to all authority, but another more recent anarchist.
He supported the South during the Civil War, too. Bakunin is no great font of all choices and knowledge. I mean, how could he support the South?
Okay, well, let me just get back to your original point here, which is, like, about authorities being legitimate, not legitimate. And one of the points that Noam Chomsky is, you know, he talks about, which I agree with, is that, look, you got a situation where, you know, some little kid is running across the street about ready to get hit by a car, and so an authority is going to grab that kid to make sure that kid doesn't get run over, and that is a legitimate, just authority. Okay, so these are again, you know, moral. These are subjective judgments about what makes a legitimate authority, and so. What he also quickly adds is that most his view is, and I also agree, most of the authorities in our society are used to just maintain power and domination and all of that. And so I think it's an important thing that there are certain areas, and I give an example for myself. My car mechanic has a history of 20 years of, like, being, you know, honest and not exploitative and all kinds of stuff. And when, you know, and he tells me, like, hey, my brakes need replacing, I tend to respect his authority, comply with that authority. But, you know, most of the other, a lot of the authorities in our society, you know, an anti-authoritarian is going to take a look at and go, like, they really are not legitimate. So I talk about my own profession as a history of not really, you know, should not be given the credibility of a legitimate authority. We can get to that later. Certainly most of the Democrat, Republican politicians, they're not, you know, if they're caring more about the, you know, rich people who are contributing to them, you know, they're certainly not legitimate authorities to have a Republican democracy. So, you know, I think it's an important distinction to, you know, of, like, what people, if you want to have a decent life and you want to have anything close to a democracy, you're making judgments about what is a legitimate authority and what isn't. And unfortunately, we've got a lot of our socialization of our society where people are just taught that, well, if something's an authority, whether it's a school teacher, you know, whoever, you're just supposed to comply with that.
Parent, automatically, you know, parent talking to a teenager. There's all sorts of, you know, illegitimate authority that needs to be challenged. I think there's less legitimate authority than even an anti-authoritarian like yourself tends to acknowledge. But I could be wrong.
Well, you got to get his book, Resisting.
I'm planning on it, actually. Okay. You know, you said enough that was real interesting, and I love Phil Oakes. And I hope you play Love Me, Love Me, Love Me, I'm a Liberal before you leave, because that's, I think Love Me, Love Me, Love Me, I'm a Liberal says a lot about KBOO and some of the problems there.
Okay.
So, and hopefully you'll give, is there a contact number for the Rethinking Psychiatry? Because I have a brand new puppy and I want to bring him. He is being trained as some sort of service dog, but anyway, I need to speak to someone before I can go to that event tonight. So if you have a contact number, that'd be great.
I don't.
I can try to look it up.
Okay. Well, thanks, Jeremy.
You don't have one?
No, I don't. Bye-bye. I don't. Maybe someone can call in with that. Maybe someone from the Rethinking Psychiatry group. I do want to talk about this whole Rethinking Psychiatry and, you know, your position as a clinical psychologist being an anti-authoritarian and how you, you know, it must be an interesting thing because, you know, as you said, psychiatrists, psychologists are often, they're sort of, they're have been given almost godlike powers in this culture. They've really, it's become such a major field. There's, you know, the therapeutic sort of culture has become a really important part of, you know, really, you know, maintaining the system of power. And so, and it's all about, you know, really mostly about helping people adapt to, as you call it, an insane society. And so it must be somewhat difficult, both professionally and, you know, you might even come upon some resistance from people that you're working with. Maybe you want to talk a little bit about that. And I know we've got Sean up next, and then other people might want to call in at 503-231-8187 to talk to my guest, Bruce Levine.
Yeah, I think, again, in a more, you know, once upon a time here, especially in the 1960s, 1970s, it wasn't all that radical at all to, like, rethink psychiatry. Is this thing, you know, what is it all about, really just taking people who are creating tension in society here and sort of pathologizing it so you don't have to take seriously what it is that they were saying? And this was, widely considered as a legitimate thing to talk about. So most famously, in the early 1970s, you had a lot of your younger audience may or may not know, but homosexuality was still being pathologized by the American Psychiatric Association up until the early 1970s. And the only reason why it was changed ultimately was political activism. So one of the key points that I make in this book, that things, you know, that are in the American Psychiatric Association's diagnostic Bible, their so-called, their DSM, which is now up to DSM-5, it's just forever expanding, getting larger and larger. But if you take a look, and that's really obvious, and I'll give you a couple other obvious examples, where it doesn't go in there for any kind of scientific reasons. It's all political and cultural, and most of the time, things, once they're in there, they don't get taken out. Homosexuality is one of the more rare examples, where because of political activism of a gay activist who were sick of being called mentally ill because of their sexual preference, they were able to, with their own activism and changing culture, were able to eliminate this. But there's other things. Well, unfortunately, what happened after that was a great success for human dignity and for freedom. But what happened in the 1980 DSM-3 was you had more kid diagnoses, and so you have a American Psychiatric Association picking on a group that has absolutely no political power in our society, and so they came up with things like oppositional defiant disorder, and as a way of, you know, the official symptoms, including often argue with adults, often refusing to comply with adults. So you have all these kids who in other periods are just viewed as a handful, or viewed as, you know, potentially anti-authoritarian kids who are, you know, in their teen years or more oppositional and creating a handful. And now you've got psychiatry just coming along and pathologizing them. And I was in graduate school at the time when this happened, so I was increasingly embarrassed by my profession. And now it's just gotten worse and worse over the years, as these kids are not only being pathologized, but they're increasingly medicated with antipsychotic drugs. So one of the points that I wanted to make in this book, I felt an obligation as a clinical psychologist to not just talk about other aspects of society, but to also talk about what was problematic about my own profession, was that my profession, just like any major institution in U.S. society, is going to receive support from the powers to be to the extent that they maintain the status quo. And to the extent that, you know, the status quo, they don't want any kind of opposition. They don't want any anti-authoritarians. And so if, you know, American Psychiatric Association is going to go ahead and pathologize a stubbornness, oppositionalness, the same kind of kids who are going to maybe one day grow up to be your Malcolm X, your Thomas Paine, your Phil Oakes, you're gonna get them early on and give them mental illness diagnosis and put them on drugs. You're gonna change the whole arc of their lives. Maybe they'll never even move into any kind of political consciousness. And this seemed to me to be a huge problem.
Yeah, and you talk about, you know, your own personal feeling of being, you know, feeling fortunate that such things were not around in your youth. And I feel the same way. When I lived in Italy for many years, and when I came back, I went to this mountain justice camp against mountaintop removal in West Virginia, where there's about 30 kind of, I thought they were pretty hotshot young folks who were, in this sort of training camp, and ended up with a direct action, very intense direct action. And in talking to some of these kids, an astounding number of them had been given these drugs from a young age. And I, you know, put two and two together. It's like, oh yeah, these are the rebels, and these are not just the rebels, these are the ones who survived what they were inflicted with in their youth and came out and obviously found, you know, the kind of things, whatever factors allowed them to get out of it, and hopefully they're all still out there kicking butt. But yeah, I was, because I kind of missed that. I missed that whole switch. I guess it had kind of started, you know, in the, you know, as you said, in the 80s, but it was not something that I was aware of, but it's become this massive, massive use of these psychoactive drugs on young people and lots of, and older people. And anyway, it's...
Yeah, I mean, a huge number of the anti-authoritarians I describe in Resisting a Legitimate Authority were young people, really super smart young people who didn't really care that much about school. So I talk about people like George Carlin, I talk about Eugene Debs, I talk about Lenny Bruce. So it's not just political activists. I talk about folks who were obviously super intelligent young folks, but blew off school. And back in that era, it wasn't that big a deal. I mean, you know, people, but nowadays, I can guarantee you, any kind of kid who's being perceived by parents or adult authorities as intelligent and not taking seriously school, they're going to have some kind of mental illness diagnosis, whether it's oppositional defiant disorder, they're going to have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It's like, you know, that kind of thing is going to happen. And, you know, another example that really should frighten a lot of folks, it does me, is you take a look at a guy like Malcolm X, who I you know, Malcolm X, in, when he's a young guy, he's actually a really good student. And then his family gets ripped apart because his father gets murdered by a white supremacist group, and the police claimed it was an accident, and the insurance companies claim it's a suicide, so the insurance companies don't even pay. It's a disaster. His family life is a disaster. His mother's completely stressed out to the point where she ends up being psychiatrically hospitalized. This whole, all him and his siblings get ripped up, the family gets ripped apart. He gets put in foster homes, and he starts to engage in stealing and getting in trouble and all kinds of stuff. And I tell folks that nowadays, I guarantee you, an African American kid who's being put in foster homes, who's engaged in some disruptive behaviors, it's like almost for sure that kid's going to be put on antipsychotic drugs. So you would have had, if what was in place today, what was in place when Malcolm X was a kid, it was in his youth, he would have maybe been put on antipsychotic drugs, and who knows what the whole arc of his whole political life would have turned out to be. So I think there is a ridiculous amount of arrogance in my profession, given our history of getting so many things wrong. And I can talk about more recent things we've gotten wrong, not just, you know, homosexuality being a mental illness, but now, you know, now they're finally admitting this whole chemical imbalance theory of depression was completely wrong. And so it's almost like you'd be hard-pressed to find something that they've gotten correct, gotten right. And so one of the ways that you want to establish whether an authority is legitimate or not, to be taken seriously or not, is like, what's their credibility? What's their track record? And my mental health profession is got a horrible track record in terms of invalid diagnoses, and problematic theories of mental illness. It's like, you'd be hard pressed to find something they've gotten right.
Well, there's just so much to talk about. As always, in talk radio, we only have an hour. And I know Sean has been, if he's still there, has been waiting very patiently for a long time. So let's bring Sean up. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Dr. Levine, I think we're coming up quickly on the 30-year anniversary of the Exxon Valdez disaster. Union membership is at an all-time low. The U.S. military is scattered all over the globe. it's hard to not be a little depressed about the whole situation. It seems like there's a lot of gaslighting going on in therapy. You talk about liberation psychology, and it seems like cognitive behavioral therapy is very solipsistic. It kind of emphasizes this sort of hyper-individualistic approach to recovery. You're already kind of talking about it, but liberation psychology, when I think of that, I think of Mr. Newman from New York, Dr. Newman. He had that whole idea of social therapy, and that kind of went off the rails, I guess. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. Also, Johan Hari, he has a great book out, Lost Connections. I really look forward to reading your book also. But I was wondering if you could contrast the whole idea of like liberation psychology versus the kind of gaslighting, you know, the kind of hyper-individualism, the solipsistic CBT stuff that's going on. Thank you.
Sure. I mean, it is very, I think it's real important that people understand the politics of what goes on in typical therapy. It's like, you know, somebody is having difficulty, for example, adjusting to a dysfunctional, abusive family or a school that's completely dissatisfying and abusive. Now, depending, if you're like a more authoritarian mental health professional, and not that all my fellow mental health professionals are authoritarian, but I went to school with these folks, I've hung out a lot of them, and most of them pretty much are. I mean, I think I know more every anti-authoritarian mental health professional in the United States, and they're a small minority. And for more authoritarian folks, they see folks who are just, you know, as soon as they see them not adjusting, whether they're not adjusting in a school or in a dysfunctional family or even in a prison, they view them as problematic, as opposed to somebody who's more authoritarian, somebody, as you use the, you know, liberation psychology, which I've written a lot about that. I talked a lot about that more in my last book, that Get Up, Stand Up, and I've written articles about liberation psychology, which is sort of a parallel to liberation theology. You know, it's sort of like, you know, to like the idea that maybe people are miserable and they're unhappy because of what's going on around them in their family, but either in the greater society. And if you're not going to have a more kind of anti-authoritarian bent, you know, as a mental health professional, you're not going to question, you know, the legitimacy of certain kind of institutions. You're going to move into like what you're talking about, terms like, you know, gaslighting. You're going to move into like having people feel that, you know, not only are they miserable. I mean, one of the real scary things about my profession is you've got people who are already feeling alienated, unhappy because they're not fitting in, you know, to in more dehumanizing situations. But now you get people feeling like, well, they're defective, you know, and they're defective. There's something wrong with them, and you know, you're breaking them even more and more. So I think part of like what's important in kind of liberation psychology, just like, you know, liberation theology, is have folks to feel like, well, you know, there's a good chance their pain is legitimate. there's a good chance, and that you need to have, you know, it's real important to have peers, probably more important than, you know, who've been through this kind of process, who are like having folks realize that their pain is legitimate, and like trying to help them do some things that are helpful with their pain. You mentioned also too, I want to show, he said he made a lot of points there. He's talking about Johann Harry's book on lost connections. It's real. I'm glad that that's getting out there. I wrote a book called, it's sort of funny for me, in 2007, a book called Surviving America's Depression Epidemic, which really I talk about, you know, pretty much a lot of the same stuff that Harry's talking about. Just he mentions that this, the whole bankruptcy of the chemical brain imbalance theory, which I talked about in 2007, but I guess it was too early. It was too radical. Now it's more mainstream to talk about that. And he talked about all the different ways people are feeling depressed and anxious because they're disconnected, and which is, again, I went into detail in Surviving America's Depression Epidemic about that, and try to kind of give people some ways of coming out of that. But I think, you know, there really are just very different ways of viewing our malaise and our misery. And people can really be behaving, you know, in really scary ways, suicidal, acting in crazy ways. But when you get down to really talking to folks, sometimes it's just very, very valid, very legitimate pain, trauma, horrible environments that are creating a certain degree of level of pain that they're not reacting to in a real wise way, often because they just don't have the support.
Sorry, I'm back. I was just trying to give a note to my board op to not replay that Phil Oakes song from the beginning, because he actually talks for about a minute at the beginning. Maybe can play the Tom Paine song, which I don't know if you've heard it. You know, are you familiar with Leon Rosselson, the songwriter, the English songwriter, Bruce?
With who? With
Leon Rosselson?
No.
Anyway, you might check him out. He's a great anti-authoritarian. He's, I think, just turned 84. Anyway, he's got an album called The Liberty Tree, which is a celebration of the life and writings of Thomas Paine. You might want to check that out. It's quite wonderful, actually.
Sounds good.
Anyway, thank you, Sean. Let me tell you what's coming up on KBOO this morning. At next, on The Politics of Living with Vicky Mazzone, she speaks with author Kristen Wilson on Other's Milk, The Potential of Exceptional Breastfeeding. At 10 on Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, author Greg Palast, right on. He'll be back on our airwaves, speaks on the U.S. moving to overthrow the duly elected government of Venezuela. At 11, it's The Bike Show. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by members' support. If you have not yet done so, become a member, you can go to kboo.fm and click on the button marked Donate. We are rapidly coming to the end of the hour. I just wanted to once again mention, you know, another thing that happens is more and more with the, you know, with capitalism, you know, seemingly in its end stages. I know that's been predicted for decades, if not centuries, but it does seem to be going into a death spiral. But anyway, the signs in Portland are all around with all the houseless people in their tents and makeshift camps. So another thing that happens to people who get in their own spiral of disintegration or distress is you lose your job, you might lose a relationship, and then you're houseless, and that makes everything oh so much worse and just multiplies the traumas. So tonight, again, Rethinking Psychiatry will host an event, Homelessness, Trauma, and Solutions, with three guest speakers from Right to Survive, speaking on trauma of becoming houseless, survival and criminalization, peer-run solutions, youth, and LGBTQ2 experience. So that's at the Montville United Methodist Church this evening, 7 to 9 p.m. That's at 232 Southeast 80th Avenue here in Portland. And Presley's been waiting also for a long time. Are you still there, Presley?
Yeah, still here.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
I discovered a 740 Avenue Power and Authority, and it got on the subject of Ayn Rand. She's a very controversial and an enigmatic figure. I'd like to know what the good Dr. Levin feels about the movie based off of her philosophy, and how many conservatives supposedly uses her doctrine to further their agendas. She has an interesting background when it comes up to coming from World War II and dealing with Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, and what and how they abused their authority. And for the record, she is against public schools. So I'll let you run with it.
Okay, thank you.
Right. Yeah, Ayn Rand, I did several years ago. Again, one of the articles that I've done that I get the most feedback with over the years, and she is certainly somebody who's against any authority who's telling her what to do, but that doesn't necessarily make somebody an anti-authoritarian. I mean, by definition, like an anti-authoritarian doesn't like pushing other people around as well. And so if you take a look at her life, Ayn Rand, there's for me an enormous amount of hypocrisy that I found. Like she's somebody who's like, you know, champions like individual freedom, but always went out of her way to make sure that she kissed up to the sort of powers to be in corporate America, which were very collective. She was very vindictive too, on a personal level. That she believed in, you know, in all kinds of freedoms, sexual freedoms. But when her younger boyfriend Nathaniel Brandon decided to like not be involved with him anymore, she really almost like engaged in behavior that was very, very similar to Stalin. This guy's life, and so. Overall, her morality of absolute selfishness, I would not put her in any kind of category of. Certainly, she hated certain authorities for good reason. She hated, you know, totalitarian Soviet and, you know, authorities, as did, by the way, Emma Goldman hated Bolsheviks and hated, you know, those too. So there are anarchists who hated Bolshevik authorities too. But, you know, she hated them. But she certainly, for me, Ayn Rand, I would not put her in any kind of category of being an anti-authoritarian. She's very, in terms of her personal life, very, very much an authoritarian person in terms of demanding complete obedience from her subordinates.
And yeah, you kind of mentioned, you lay out some various different ways of relating to, whether it's authority or to, you know, other people, the status quo. You mentioned dissent. Being oppositional, being contrarian, or don't equate with being anti-authoritarian.
Right. I mean, there's a difference, for example, somebody who is oppositional or just opposed to everything, you know, like, and one of the points that I make for a lot of young people, that's who they start at, and eventually, you know, if you don't drug them and you care about them, they're going to move into mature into more legitimate anti-authoritarians who are actually assessing whether an authority is legitimate or not before they take it seriously. And then the term contrarian, again, you know, they have in common with anti-authoritarians both are not afraid to be disliked and unpopular, but the contrarian is just sort of somebody who's going to be somebody who's like buying stock when everybody's not buying stock, or they're opposed to a war when everybody's for it, or for a war when everybody's opposed to it. You know, so that's a contrarian. They're opposed to, you know, sort of like what's popular, and that's different than an anti-authoritarian who is like assessing their opposition based on the legitimacy of the authority, not on the popularity of something.
Well, we only have about, you know, 6 minutes left or so we got a couple callers. Let's try to get them both in if possible. John, you're on the air.
I know we don't have much time, but do you have any professional comments on the President of the United States?
Do I have any, like, professional comments? Like, are you?
Yeah,
like,
I know we don't have much time. I know you could probably go on forever on this guy, but, you know.
Right. Well, I would say I clearly don't like him. I think he's a jerk. I mean, I grew up, before I moved to Cincinnati, I grew up in New York, and he was, like, when I was, you know, a young guy there in New York, and he was starting out, he was just viewed as a comical fool. And it's sort of, like, pretty pathetic statement that this is the guy that Americans have as their president. In terms of making a professional statements, I think one of the interesting things that, in terms of, like, everybody on the left now wants to pathologize Donald Trump, you know, call him some kind of a psychiatric personality disorder, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I think you want to think a couple. I think one of the interesting things for me is you can't have it both ways. You can't go around and if you're on a, you know, liberal, you know, type of person, this is the kind of person who one of your calls is making, you know, Phil Oakes is talking about the Phil Oakes song, Lovely, Lovely, I'm a Liberal. And this is the kind of Lovely, Lovely, I'm a Liberal kind of hypocrisy of, like, on the one hand, you want to, like, destigmatize mental illness, you know, and on the other hand, you want to use mental illness labels to insult people and discredit them. You can't really have it both ways. I just, rather than pathologizing them as mentally ill, I'd rather just call the guy just a stupid jerk. Is that good enough?
Oh, yeah, I understand. I heard that, you know, like, New York voted 9-1 against him in the 2016. So no one, you know. Whatever.
Exactly. Everybody in Manhattan or in Queens or any place in New York City, they've had contact with him and they knew what he was all about. And I think it was just, you know, just shocking that not the majority. I guess he never did get the majority vote, but he got a lot of people voting for a guy. You know, and it's I think that's the kind of stuff that rocks anti-authoritarians. And you know, it's just, but it's not the first time in American history that we've had some kind of deeply problematic guy become president.
Well, thank you, John. Let's go straight to Jill. We only have a couple minutes left. Go ahead, Jill. You're on the air.
It's Joe, but I'm glad to get in. You brought up oppositional defiant disorder, which is a label that was put on me as a child. I was one of those smart kids who blew off school too. And I came to later resonate with, you know, anti-authoritarian critiques of this as a way of kind of gaslighting a population of people with anti-authoritarian values. But I've also done therapeutic work myself and have come to recognize that there, you know, are these psychological hang-ups that people have for their own personal life history reasons with figures of authority that don't necessarily express anti-authoritarian values but bring them into conflict with authority. And I was wondering if you could just comment on that nuance, on how it's not simply a, you know, made-up thing.
Sure. First of all, congratulations for surviving there. And, you know, that's part of the point that I try to make in the book. A lot of folks, a lot of young people start out naturally just, you know, they see illegitimate authorities everywhere and they're oppositional. And the folks who have more of a quality of life, they mature into a more nuanced view that there are actually some authorities out there in their life, whether it's their car mechanic or there is some, you know, maybe an occasional professor that actually knows what they're talking about, and it's to their benefit to take seriously what they're saying. And I think that the more, you know, that a young person is, they're willing, their guts to be oppositional is validated and cared about, and they've experienced some affection and respect for having some courage to challenge, that the more likelihood they're going to mature from just being oppositional to being more anti-authoritarian in a way that's going to help their own life and help society.
And I think he was also saying maybe that there's, we're hearing a very young person in the background, that possibly the beneficial uses of therapy that obviously you believe in as a clinical psychologist.
Right. I think it's just real important, rather than, you know, taking somebody and just invalidating them as mentally ill, that if you're with some young person who is, you know, naturally more stubborn, more noncompliant, is to have some respect for that. There's some great value in that. But just like anything, any trait in life, you know, when things become rigid, it can be detrimental.
Thank you. That speaks to what I was hoping you would.
Okay. Well, thank you, Joe. We are just about out of time. You have is there something burning thing that you wanted to say that you didn't get a chance to say?
No, just thank you for playing the Phil Oaks, and I think we covered a lot of ground. Like I said, basically, this book, Resisting Illegitimate Authority, is about, it's about anti-authoritarians, and it's for them, and it's just trying to help them, you know, navigate the U.S. society, which, you know, it's not the most, U.S. society, I make it clear, is not the most authoritarian society out there on the planet right now. But I think what happens for a lot of anti-authoritarians living in the United States is they're not told that it still is a pretty authoritarian society, and so they get confused a lot, and so this book is basically aimed to kind of help them out, help them to survive, help them to triumph.
Okay, and get down to City Hall at 10 o'clock for the hearing on a compassionate change district, perhaps versus, or I don't know, the enhanced services district. That's this morning. Thank you, Bruce, so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul. It was fun.
Okay, Resisting Illegitimate Authority, and we got more great programming here on KBOO Community Radio. Thanks for listening.
In a building of gold with riches untold live the families in which the country was founded, and the merchants of style with their vain velvet smiles were there, for they also were hounded. And the soft middle class crowded into the last, for the building was fully surrounded. And the noise outside was the ringing of revolution. Sadly they stared and sank in their chairs and searched for a comforting notion. And the rich silver walls looked ready to fall as they shook in doubtful devotion. The ice cubes would clink as they freshened their drinks, wet their minds in bitter emotion. And they talked about the ringing of rain.